The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Scott Youngkin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from the Harvard Health Letter, from UCLA Health, and from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. First article comes from the Harvard Health Letter, published by the Harvard Medical School. Which painkiller is safest for you? Have a headache, muscle strain, or maybe arthritis pain? Don't reach for just any over-the-counter OTC remedy. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen and aspirin are commonly used over-the-counter painkillers. So is acetaminophen. For decades, these drugs were thought to be entirely safe, justifying the ability to purchase them without a doctor's prescription. But the thinking on over-the-counter painkillers has changed now that we know more about their risks, and it's especially important to navigate these medications with care. Here are guidelines to help you narrow the options. Non-prescription painkillers are associated with many health problems. Regular, long-term use of NSAIDs can irritate the stomach lining and cause ulcers or stomach bleeding. Recognition of this led to the development of stomach-sparing NSAIDs, like the prescription medication celecoxib or Celebrex, which are somewhat less likely to cause stomach problems. Unfortunately, in recent years, research has shown that all NSAIDs, including the stomach-sparing ones, tend to increase blood pressure. In addition, in 2015, the FDA warned that all NSAIDs raise the risk for heart attack and stroke, even with short-term use, and even among people who don't have known heart disease. NSAIDs can also cause kidney damage when taken in high doses. These increased risks are small but real, and are more likely with higher daily doses. Acetaminophen can also be dangerous. Taking large amounts of acetaminophen can lead to liver failure, which may require hospitalization or possibly liver transplantation, and may even lead to death, warns Dr. Susan Lim, a pain medicine specialist with Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Most people should not exceed 3,000 milligrams in a day. That's just 6 extra-strength acetaminophen pills, notes Dr. Joseph Gagne, a pharmacist and epidemiologist with Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Avoid the offenders. It's best to stay away from or minimize the use of the over-the-counter painkillers that can make your existing health conditions worse. For example, don't take acetaminophen if you have a liver problem or if you're a heavy drinker, which can also cause liver damage. Likewise, don't take NSAIDs without first talking to your doctor if you have a heart disease, high blood pressure, stomach ulcers, or kidney problems. NSAIDs can worsen kidney issues to the point of kidney failure, requiring hospitalization, Dr. Lim notes. An exception for NSAID use and heart disease, your doctor may direct you to take a daily low-dose aspirin, which is known to help stave off a second heart attack or stroke if you've already had one. Consider other medications. Another factor in your choice of an OTC painkiller is whether it will interact with your other medications. For example, NSAIDs affect the way blood platelets work. If you take a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug with aspirin or a blood thinner such as warfarin, apixaban, which is Eliquis, rivaroxaban, which is Xarelto, or dabigatran, which is Pradaxa, you may increase bleeding risk, especially in the digestive tract. Taking NSAIDs may also increase your bleeding risk if you use corticosteroids or certain antidepressants. NSAIDs can also reduce the effects of many drugs that lower blood pressure, Dr. Gagne said. These include ACE inhibitors such as lisinopril, angiotensin receptor blockers such as losartan, which is Cozaar, or valsartan, which is Diovan, and diuretics such as hydrochlorothiazide, which is Esedrex. Something else to note, some OTC combination drugs, such as cold and sleep remedies, already contain acetaminophen or other painkillers. If you're not aware of that, you may unintentionally go beyond safe dosing limits, Dr. Lim says. Tens of thousands of people are hospitalized every year for accidental acetaminophen overdose. What if you're a candidate for both? If you don't have an existing health condition or medication regimen that dictates which OTC painkiller to take, Dr. Lim suggests starting with acetaminophen since it has fewer risks than NSAIDs when taken at recommended levels. Take the lowest dose possible for the shortest period of time to achieve adequate pain relief. Try the medication for a few days as directed and monitor the response, she advises. If it's not providing relief, try another. What if both NSAIDs and acetaminophen work for you? Dr. Lim suggests alternating acetaminophen and NSAIDs, making sure that you take them in safe doses and intervals, Dr. Lim advises. But remember, non-prescription painkillers are meant for occasional or short-term use, unless your doctor recommends otherwise. Set your expectations to manage pain, not make it go away altogether, Dr. Lim says. Don't continuously and unsafely take medication to make your pain level diminish to zero. And the next article we have is called Heartburn Medication Update, and it comes from the Harvard Health Letter of June 2020. New information may affect your approach to treatment. Millions of people turn to prescription and over-the-counter medications to cope with heartburn from gastroesophageal reflux disease or other stomach conditions. But navigating the risks of heartburn remedies can leave a sour taste in your mouth, since some have been tied to health concerns. Here is what you need to know about two mainstays of treatment and how the latest developments may affect you. First, we're going to talk about H2 blockers. Histamine 2 receptor antagonists, better known as H2 blockers, include famotidine, known as Pepcid, and cimetidine, known as Tagamet, and are available over-the-counter or by prescription. They block a chemical that signals the stomach to produce acid and are the go-to drugs when an antacid like Tums or aluminum hydroxide Maalox isn't strong enough. Last year, drug makers began recalling the H2 blocker ranitidine after the FDA detected the cancer-causing chemical N-nitrosodimethylamine, NDMA, in several brand-name Zantac and generic versions of the medication. In April 2020, the FDA called for all ranitidine products to be pulled from shelves and urged consumers to stop taking the medications. The FDA has also urged a voluntary recall of nizatidine, or Axid, due to the detection of NDMA in some batches. If you've been taking ranitidine or nizatidine for a long time, talk to your doctor about other options. None of the other H2 blockers have been found unsafe, said Dr. Kyle Staller, a gastroenterologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. As of April 2020, no NDMA has been found in famotidine or cimetidine. And just to remember, famotidine is also called Pepcid. Are there risks to using H2 blockers? Cimetidine may interfere with the absorption of anticoagulants, antidepressants, and blood pressure medications. But Dr. Staller says, generally speaking, there are no long or short-term health risks of using H2 blockers. The bigger issues, he explains, are that H2 blockers aren't always effective at acid suppression, and over time they may not work as well as the body gets used to them. Now we're going to talk about proton pump inhibitors. Proton pump inhibitors, or PPIs, such as omeprazole, Prilosec, lansoprazole, Prevacid, or esomeprazole, Nexium, are stronger than H2 blockers. They inhibit certain cells from pumping acid into the stomach, which lowers acid levels and heartburn pain. PPIs are available over-the-counter or by prescription and are considered safe in the short term. Long-term risks, however, have been a concern for years. In the past, the drugs have been linked to reduced levels of vitamin B12, magnesium, and calcium. And some studies have indicated they might increase the risk for hip fracture, pneumonia, kidney, cardiovascular disease, and dementia. Concerns raised by these studies may wind up hurting people. People who really need to be on PPIs for severe heartburn, ulcer disease, or Barrett's esophagus, a potential precursor to esophageal cancer, have stopped taking the medication, but we don't have evidence to justify doing this, Dr. Steller said. Fortunately, better evidence indicates that PPIs are safe. A randomized trial published online May 29, 2019 by Gastroenterology Journal followed 17,000 older adults for about 3 years and found no link between PPI use and increased rates of pneumonia, fractures, type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, dementia, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or cancer. There was no link between PPI use and these conditions. More recently, a review of studies that include more than 640,000 people published online January 2, 2020 by the American Journal of Gastroenterology found no increased risk for dementia among PPI users. So why have there been associations between PPIs and other health problems in the past? Most people who take PPIs tend to be less healthy than those who don't, and most studies are observational, meaning they don't prove that PPIs cause the other conditions, Dr. Steller said. That said, there is one recognized risk of PPI use. Stomach acid helps prevent bacteria from getting into your body. If you make less stomach acid, you're at increased risk for gastrointestinal infections. But Dr. Steller says that's not enough reason to stop taking PPIs if someone's deriving real benefit from them. What you should do. If you have new heartburn symptoms, don't jump to a PPI first. First, said Dr. Steller, try some pill-free changes. Quit smoking, lose weight, and avoid food and drink that triggers heartburn. If that doesn't give enough relief, start with antacids. If they aren't effective, move up to an H2 blocker for a few weeks. If that doesn't work, try a PPI. If you're still having heartburn after 2 weeks of PPI use, talk to your doctor. It's time to get to the root of the problem. You may need more diagnostic tests and different treatments. And don't suddenly stop taking PPIs. That can cause a rebound effect and worsen your heartburn. Now we're going to turn to an article from UCLA Health. This article is entitled, Are You Tired All the Time? These non-sleep-related conditions may be the cause of your fatigue. If you are frequently exhausted during the day, you may suspect a sleep disorder. And while it's a good place to start, there may be some other reasons for your daytime tiredness. Fatigue and sleepiness are two different things, explains clinical psychologist Jennifer Martin, Ph.D., of the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. Sleepiness means you're not getting enough good quality sleep, and during the day you can't keep your eyes open. Fatigue is not having a lot of energy. You can feel that way from having chronic pain, stress, or exercising too much. Anemia. Also known as having low red blood cell count, anemia can cause fatigue, shortness of breath, and headaches. In addition to having lower than normal amounts of red blood cells, the cells may not have enough hemoglobin, an iron-rich protein that helps circulate oxygen around the body. Anemia can be mild and it can be severe, but both should be treated. A blood test can reveal if you are anemic. Common causes are deficiencies in iron, folate, or vitamin B12. Food rich in these nutrients can help correct the problem. The foods you choose. Not eating enough and eating the wrong foods, like highly processed and sugary foods such as donuts, won't provide the nutritional fuel you need to power through the day, which can lead to feeling tired. Combining protein with a complex carbohydrate will help you to stave off hunger and help keep your body and brain energized. Some people tell me they get tired after eating certain foods, says Dr. Martin. If you eat something that makes you tired, don't eat it. Likewise, if you eat something at night that keeps you awake, avoid that food. Underactive thyroid. The thyroid gland makes a hormone that affects metabolism and is involved with how the body converts energy from food. Hypothyroidism is a medical term for an underactive thyroid. When food metabolizes too slowly, the result can be fatigue. The disease is more common among people over 60 and affects women more than men. To diagnose hypothyroidism, a physician will take a full medical history and perform blood tests to check thyroid function and hormone levels. The condition is treatable with medications. Depression. It's commonly thought of as a mental and emotional disorder, but depression also has physical symptoms, including headaches, loss of appetite, and fatigue. Depression is one of the most common disorders in the United States and can happen at any age. In older adults, depression can occur in tandem with other serious chronic conditions. Being depressed drains energy. Sometimes the medications used to treat depression may help resolve the fog of depression, but the medication side effects may include fatigue. Always report any medication side effects to your physician, as there may be other options to try. Urinary tract infections. Urinary tract infections are among the most common infections. Women are most likely to get them, and men, especially as they get older, are more prone to UTIs as well. While burning and itching upon urination are the most typical symptoms, older adults are more likely to feel tired, shaky, weak, and have muscle aches. Any infection can make people feel tired, says Dr. Martin. It can cause both fatigue and sleepiness. It's also harder to get good sleep because you may have pain or other symptoms from the infection. Dehydration. Not getting enough fluids can lead to fatigue. While the general rule of thumb has been 8 8-ounce glasses of water per day, it may be different for you. If you sweat a lot, you'll need more. Simply hiking outdoors on a hot, humid day can cause you to perspire more than you think. Drink water before such an outing or a hard workout like tennis. Depending on how long you're at the activity, it may help to drink a little during your activity as well. You know you are well hydrated when urine is light in color. There are many other medical conditions such as heart and lung disease, diabetes, and fibromyalgia, as well as medications that can cause fatigue. Sometimes trying a different medication or taking it at a different time of day can solve the problem. Now I'm going to read information from an article called Organ Transplants, and this is a special report from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. This is a fairly long article, and I may not cover all the material. Organ transplants are an increasingly common option for older adults. Your heart, your lung, your kidneys, your liver. Like most people, you probably take these organs for granted, barely giving them a second thought, unless there's a problem. Sometimes these vital organs can stop working properly due to factors such as disease, a congenital defect, or lifestyle factors like smoking or excessive drinking. Eventually, sometimes after years of declining health, these organs can even fail. And when medications and other treatments are no longer effective, an organ transplant may be the only life-saving option remaining. Successful organ transplants are a remarkable innovation of the 20th century, preventing death and restoring quality of life for thousands of people every year. In 2019, there were 38,500 heart, lung, kidney, and liver transplants in the United States. Kidney transplants are by far the most common, with over 23,000, followed by about 8,900 liver transplants. In the past, not many organ transplants were performed on older adults. In 1988, adults 65 and older received only 265 organs, which was only 2% of all transplants. But the transplantation landscape has drastically changed since then. The annual number of adults age 65 or older receiving transplants has since increased over 30 times to about 8,600 transplants in 2019. That increase is due to the aging population, better transplant results, and updated transplantation guidelines. When determining whether someone should receive a transplant, many doctors place more significance on an adult's overall health, his or her physiologic age, than just his or her chronologic age, or how old they are. For example, frailty, a limited capacity to respond to stress or bounce back from injury or surgery, seems to be an important factor, as it has been linked with health problems after transplantation, including an increased risk of premature death. Older adults undergoing a transplant may have additional hurdles, including coexisting health needs. It's common for older adults to take numerous medications, some of which could potentially interact with the immune system, causing suppression or immunosuppression, drugs that are necessary after transplantation to prevent organ rejection. Side effects of post-transplant therapy. Immunosuppression drugs can aggravate existing medical problems, such as a tremor, diabetes, kidney failure, or high blood pressure. On the positive side, immune systems naturally weaken with age. This might work to the advantage of older organ recipients and lower their chances of acute organ rejection. Overall, Mayo Clinic experts say that when older transplant candidates are carefully screened and selected, they can experience excellent results. Now, there's a process that has to occur before a transplant can occur. You need an access to a healthy organ. This can sometimes occur fairly quickly, but in other cases, it can involve a long wait. In January 2020, there were about 113,000 people on the national waiting list for an organ. The national transplant waiting list is run by the United Network for Organ Sharing and is intended to ensure organs are distributed efficiently and equitably. Every time a new organ becomes available, potential recipients are ranked according to a set of rules. Allocation rules vary depending on the organ, weighing factors like blood type, waiting time, medical need, organ size, and geography. For example, because heart and lungs need to be transplanted within 4 to 6 hours, greater priority is given to recipients who live near the donor hospital. If the first potential recipient is unable to immediately receive the donation, perhaps due to a health issue like an infection, it's offered to the next person on the list. Donors and recipients do not need to be the same race, but certain blood types are more prevalent in certain ethnicities. Because a compatible blood type is usually necessary for transplants, the need for donor organs from minority ethnicities is very high. Though some transplants can use organs from living donors, and greater numbers of older adults are receiving organs from living donors, most are performed using organs from deceased donors. The reliance on a limited number of deceased donors means there are still many older adults who never receive needed transplants. Sadly, over 1,500 adults 65 and older died while on the waiting list in 2019. To help offset this need, transplant recipients, including older adults, are also accepting donor organs that at one time would have been deemed unacceptable. Sometimes called extended or expanded criteria donor organs, they may fall short of ideal for a number of reasons, such as coming from donors who were older or who had certain health issues. While these organs carry higher risks, their availability may cut down on the waiting time for an organ. Some older adults have taken advantage of their relative ability with positive results. An important thing to think about is racial disparities. As in many other areas of healthcare, when it comes to transplants, racial minorities, especially African Americans in need of a kidney transplant, have historically faced certain disparities in the United States. Some of these disparities include need for a transplant. African Americans are overrepresented on the kidney waiting list. As of January 2019, African Americans make up 32% of the waiting list, but only about 13% of the U.S. population. In 2016, end-stage renal disease was over three times as common among African Americans as in white Americans. Barriers to transplant. Compared with white Americans, African Americans have faced barriers to receiving a kidney transplant, including a lower chance of receiving a transplant referral. Worse outcomes. The most recent annual report from the Scientific Registry of Transplant Recipients showed that African Americans had a lower graft survival rate than white Americans who received a living donor kidney. But there has also been progress. In the past, African Americans on the transplant waiting list received kidney transplants from deceased donors at a disproportionately low rate. The United Network for Organ Sharing took measures to address this, such as adjusting its organ matching criteria and allocation policies. In 2017, UNOS announced that African American patients were receiving organs from deceased donors at what was seen as an equitable rate. However, there is still much work to be done, including overcoming mistrust in minority communities due to historic racism in healthcare systems. You might wonder, how do you get put on the waiting list for a transplant? Well, first of all, you have to get a referral from your doctor. Then you have to select a transplant center. There are 200 in the United States, taking into account your preferences, your insurance, your geographic location, and other factors. You also have to be evaluated by a transplant team at your chosen center. The team will determine whether receiving a transplant is a viable option for you. Among other things, the team may review your physical and mental health, your insurance, and your finances. Depending on the transplant center, your drug, alcohol, or smoking habits may prevent or delay the transplant. Standards vary, but programs generally will not perform a transplant if your substance use poses a potential threat. Well, we've run out of time, and we'll continue this article next time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.